I was just out of college, and I was asked to go on a mission trip with several college students to the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. We spent 6-7 weeks in the villages, working among Mayans, helping the churches there run vacation Bible schools. And the opportunity to serve with them, as well as what God did in our community living together for 6-7 weeks straight, was absolutely amazing. Issues came up. You know, when you live with anyone that long that you don't know, issues come up. We had to work through struggle. Lives were transformed. God worked. We were blessed by the community. 6-7 weeks of just an amazing trip. And then after this was all over, we all went away for a week to debrief our experience. We had all the college students there. They each went around and shared what God did in their lives during the time, what was difficult, what was great, what they learned, how they'll be changed when they get back home. It was just one of those great debriefs even. And after that debrief was over, the college students all left, but all the leaders stayed. And I remember I was sitting on a chair just like this. And when the last college student left, I looked at the remaining leaders and I said, okay, what's next? And they looked at me kind of shocked. I'm like, what? And one of them said, John, we just went through a life transforming experience. And as soon as the last college student left, you closed the book and you're ready to move on to the next topic. Can we just stay in the moment a little bit? Can we just kind of savor a little bit what God is doing? And that was just a lesson for me that often after we go through big and life transforming things, at least my personality type, I'm ready to get to the next thing. Let's move on. But there is something about savoring, about sitting in something and letting God speak to you that's so helpful after an experience like that. Last week, Josh preached the last section of Romans, Romans 16, and the original schedule is move on to the next thing today as we go into God's Word. But I just first reminded the story, and God, I think, was just saying, you know, we need to just stop at least for a week and say, what did God teach us through going through the book of Romans? We spent almost the whole school year going through this, and before moving on to what's next, I just thought it'd be really good for us to slow down and just sit with God and say, God, what did you teach us through going through this letter? And who will we be because of what you're doing in this letter? Holy Spirit, teach us. So that's what I want to do today. I want to do a quick overview of what did we learn and then just kind of bring it home for us. What does it mean for us today? Now, just some background, if we just want to remember why this letter was written, there's really two stories colliding. And when you understand what these two stories are, they help you understand why the book of why the letter of Romans was written and what question it was trying to answer then and what question it answers for us today. The first story is Paul's own story in the church of Antioch. I won't go through his own story, but he went through a radical conversion experience, and much of his pastoral discipleship, in other words, where he grew as a pastor, was in this church of Antioch. Antioch was a unique church there because it was the first multi-ethnic church. The church primarily was a Jewish movement, and due to persecution, a church started in Antioch as well. And not only was this church a new church, it had Jews and Gentiles. It had people from different ethnicities, and they loved each other deeply. It was in this church that people were first called Christians. This is just a helpful reminder of our identity, that the word Christian applied to a multi-ethnic group of people loving each other in the same church. And this is what Paul was mentored in. Barnabas took him under his wing, and he grew as a pastor, grew as a follower of Jesus in this environment that not only was diverse, but it was diverse with love. There was a sense of diversity with love. Now, that's one story, but there was another story going on concurrently. Another church was starting in Rome. This church was a little different because there was no pastor or apostle who started it. We believe that this church was started by Jewish followers of Jesus who met Jesus through the Pentecost in Jerusalem and went back home to Rome. And so this church started in Rome that was probably primarily Jewish, but also had Gentiles. We believe that there was a season when Jews in Rome were cast out, and so the church that remained was mostly a Gentile, a non-Jewish church. And when the Jews who followed Jesus returned, there was a cultural clash. The church didn't feel as Jewish anymore. It felt more Gentile, the way they worshiped, the way they talked, the traditions they celebrated. And so this church in Rome was interesting because on paper, they looked the same as the church of Antioch. The diversity was amazing. But in practicality, it was very different than Antioch. It was like the church of Antioch, but with no love. And so you had this church here that was diverse, but mimicked their society in the tensions, the racial tensions, the ethnic tensions. What was happening in Rome was kind of happening in the church in Rome as well. This could be the problem of our own church and our own town and our own country, is we may look good on paper, we may get along on paper, but sometimes the values of society about how we relate have a greater influence than what the church is supposed to be about, what the church, what God has shaped the church to be. And so as we think of differences across race, differences across age, differences across gender, the question we need to ask is, do we mimic similar values in our churches, our society? Or are we an alternative community that give a preview of God's kingdom of heaven on earth? This was Paul's major concern. You know, as we went through a season of COVID, of racial tension, of political tension, the question we had to ask is, was the church similar to our society? Was our church similar to our society? Or was it different? Paul, I think, was pretty concerned. In fact, he writes in the first chapter of Romans, he says, he's looking at this church that had the diversity of Antioch, but not the love of Antioch. And he says this, I am obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and to the foolish. That is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are in Rome. He says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel. What I'm about to tell you about the good news, he says, I'm not ashamed of it because it has the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in this gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. That righteousness of God phrase is throughout the letter of Romans. It's a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Paul says, hey, look, what I learned in my experience of Antioch is there is something about the good news of God that brings people together who are on polar opposites of the political spectrum, polar opposite on the racial spectrum, polar opposites on the socioeconomic class spectrum. There is something about the gospel that infiltrates, changes our minds, and shapes how we love one another. And so here's what I want to do. I really believe there's like two sticking points in the letter of Rome that Paul wants to make sure stay with us. And I brought Elmer's glue with me just to illustrate that there are two things that I think I would want you, church, to remember that would be sticky, that you would not forget, that it would just be ingrained in you because it's this gospel that changes how we think of one another and how we relate to one another. And so with that, I just want to emphasize again that when it comes to tension within the church, what Paul says is we need to look up first. We need to look at what God has done for us, because something about what God has done for us answers the question as how we're to relate to one another. So there's two sticking points, two things he wants us to remember, two things I want you to remember. And here's the first one. The world's a mess. And so are you, and so am I. That's the first sticking point. The world's a mess, but even more personally, so are you, and so am I. He starts the letter of Romans by saying, hey, look, God has made his existence obvious to people. Just by looking at nature, we should at least be able to know there is a God who exists. But he says that we have suppressed the knowledge. In fact, he plays a trick on us. He says, let's look outside the window. Let's look at the world. And he says, haven't they suppressed the knowledge of God? God is so obvious to them, but it's clear that they have suppressed that knowledge. Instead, what they've done, they've given the glory that belongs to God, and they've taken it from him and transferred that glory. And glory is this idea of praise and worship and awe and wonder. They've taken that glory from God, and they've given it to things that God has created. Good things, but they become the center of our glory rather than God himself. He says, here's the problem with that. He says, God was upset with this, and his consequence to humanity is he removed boundaries. He removed boundaries around sexual relationships, and he removed boundaries around just personal relationships. So there is a sexual brokenness in our society, and there is relational chaos. And to add to all of that, people in our world celebrate both the sexual brokenness and the relational chaos, and they approve those who live in that brokenness. And so Paul paints a picture of this world is messed up, and then he plays a trick on us. He says, you know that smog out there? You know that awfulness out there? He says, that smoke, that smog is coming from our own lungs in our church as well. He's saying, this is produced by us. In fact, in Romans 2:1, he says, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself. Why? Because you who pass judgment do the same thing. Paul's saying, look, everything I just described about how broken our world is, it's happening in your life too. You can't point the finger out there when the smog you see out there is produced by your own lungs. And then he says, look, church, there will be a judgment day before God where each of us stand before God and we will be judged by our own unrighteousness of taking away glory from God, putting that glory on other things, and experiencing the same sexual brokenness, experiencing the same relational chaos. But the difference was out there, at least they're honest about it and they affirm people who do that. Here in the church, we condemn those who do that even though we practice the same things. He says, look, we're under judgment. And here's the thing. He says, stop denying this. And again, he says, you've got to hold on to this. See, we have a problem in our society in that in our desire to love, I think the motivation is good, we are so concerned about our own self-esteem and people's self-esteem that we minimize our own sin. We minimize our own brokenness. We try to evade it by changing the subject and talk about, oh, we need to build people's character and self-esteem. I'm not denying that. Those are great values. But when that turns into denial of our own brokenness, there's a problem. In our sermons, I showed you a picture of Steve Jobs before he was sick and after he was sick and denied his illness. And the thing that Paul is really trying to ingrain here is that when you deny your brokenness, it actually hurts you. Romans 3:9, the second half says, for we already have made the charge that Jews and Gentiles are alike. We are all under the power of sin. We can give excuses of, oh, well, that's because we were raised a certain way, or we weren't given certain things that other people might have. All those things may be true, but God says, even with all those influences where we all weren't dealt the same cards, we all bear a responsibility. We're not 100% helpless, but rather we are responsible for our own conduct. So, church, I think one of the first implications of this gospel is you can't get to the good news unless you're honest about the bad news. That we're broken before God. And no matter who you think you are, no matter how good you think you are, no matter how many excuses you want to make, no matter what you can point to about your upbringing, no matter what you say to protect your heart, unless you just stick with this and say, I'm a mess before God. I am so broken before God. If you don't get there, if you don't stop denying, then you're going to miss out on this good news. So one of the things that Paul really wants us to stick with is, man, we're broken before God. We are all under the same situation. And this goes across race. This goes across gender. This goes across class. This goes across any difference. Whether you're oppressed or you're the oppressor, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're non-educated, have tons of education, whether you're female or male, there is a level playing field before God. We are all guilty of denying God his glory, worshiping other things, and experiencing the brokenness as a result of that. That's the first kind of sticky point that Paul wants to make. But then he goes on to another sticking point that he wants to make sure we know. And he says this in Romans 3:21. But now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. In Romans chapter 3, he switches the focus. Up until now, it's been about our own righteousness. But now Paul reintroduces this idea of the righteousness of God. And it's a switch in topic. Here's what's very interesting is if you talk to most people about the book of Romans, they would talk about it as a heavy theology book about God's forgiveness. And I want you to know the word forgiveness, even the root word of forgiveness in the Greek is mentioned. Actually, I want you to guess how many times the word forgiveness is mentioned in the book of Romans. The answer is once. And even that one time, it's not really Paul. He's quoting an Old Testament passage. This letter is not about God's forgiveness. This letter is about God's righteousness given to you. And what we learn about this is that God actually makes a way in our brokenness to receive his righteousness. Now, what do we learn about God's righteousness? This is what we learn. Verse 22 of chapter 3. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Here's this interesting thing about God's righteousness that's so different than our righteousness. The first thing is God, it's given to us. It's a gift. God gives it to us. The second thing we learn, it's available to everyone. There's no ladder to climb on this one. This is given to everyone. And finally, there's a method of obtaining it. And this method is through Jesus Christ, faith in him because of what he's done on the cross. Verse 25, God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. This is a crazy thing. This letter is not about forgiveness. It's about God giving people his righteousness. See, forgiveness says, you've blown it, but now I forgive you. God's righteousness given to us says, you never did anything wrong in the first place. Forgiveness says, okay, I forgive you. You can go your way. Righteousness says, you never did anything wrong. Come on in. This is what God gives us through Jesus' death on the cross and receiving this gift through trust and faith and Jesus Christ. And the amazing news is, though we will face God in final judgment, what God says is that because of what Christ has done through faith in him, in that moment of judgment, at that point, God will say, you have my righteousness. You never did anything wrong. And the cool thing is that's a future thing, but we're able to live in that identity today. We're able to claim that we are, when we approach God, we have the righteousness, God's righteousness, when we approach him, because that Jesus in his joy took on the sacrifice of our sin, and all we need to do is place our trust in him, that the work has been done. And the cool thing about this is that God is the initiator of this. We often pick God versus Jesus. And the truth is, no, God's the initiator of this. He has been pursuing you since the fall, since our sin was introduced. He is doing this. And in the same way that Paul says, hey, stop denying your sin, he also says, this is a sticking point. Stop denying what God has done for you on the cross. Stop it. You need to glue this onto your body, glue this onto your heart, what God has done. And I think Paul has this story that the way God reached Paul, the author of this letter, wasn't when Paul had this aha experience and turned to God. Paul was on his way to kill and jail Christians. And that is when God showed that he was pursuing him. So Paul has this clear sense of God pursued us when we were sinners, when our back was turned towards him. He pursued you when you were even looking for it. Romans 5:10, for if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? If God pursued us while our backs were towards him, if God pursued us where we said, forget you, God, if God pursued us when we said we want to choose our own way and we don't want anything to do with you, and God pursued us in the midst of that, how much more does God want to bless us when we turn back towards him and receive what he has to offer? This is the amazing thing about God, his lavishness to you, what he wants to give you through his righteousness. And one of the greatest gifts Paul says that he gives in addition to his righteousness is that God gives us his spirit to be in us. This is the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead. It's now in you when you put your faith in Christ. And we don't have time to go through all of this, but you can listen to past sermons. But not only does God give you his righteousness, he gives you his spirit. His spirit actually is the one that sanctifies you, who changes you from the inside out. His spirit is the one that adopts you so you can relate to God as Abba, Father, Daddy. His spirit is the one that adopts you and gives you new brothers and sisters. His spirit is the one that gives you a new body after your death, a resurrected body, a resurrection. This new spirit gives you an inheritance. God is so generous. And so Paul says, not only do you need to glue into your heart that you are an absolute mess, and that equals the playing field, but that God, through faith in Jesus Christ and his death on the cross, gives you his righteousness. So stop denying it. Live that way as well. And so he concludes with this. He says, there is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. No matter who you are, no matter your height, your weight, your looks, your gender, your ethnicity, your education level, you just name the difference. We all have the same two stories. We are all sinful. We've all fallen short of God's glory, and God has given all of us his righteousness and his justification through faith. It's available to all. This is the level playing field that God gives us, that Paul shares about in the book of Romans. So, what does this mean for today? These are the two sticking points. What does this mean for today? So Paul then in Romans chapter 12 switches the focus. He says, look, in light of God's mercy to you, there are some implications for how we live. And he's speaking again to a church in Rome that has been experiencing tensions, probably political tensions, probably racial tensions. He says, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for you and your diversity? And the first thing he says is you've got to, in Romans 12:12, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He basically says, look, there's a way our world lives and all these differences, but you can't be conformed to that. Because of what God has done for you, it actually means thinking differently about each other. We can't borrow what's out there and apply it in here. We have to create a new type of culture in light of the gospel, in light of what God has done for you. We have a different view of each other than our society has when it comes to difference. So, okay, what's the different view? What is it? How are we supposed to do this? And I love that in light of all that Paul's written, his first thing is this. Romans 12:3, for he says, by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. He's like, stop it. Stop looking across difference and think, I'm a little better. Stop looking at each other and thinking, I have more to my credit. There's no bragging in heaven. There's no bragging in the church. We're all just as messed up, and we're all just as saved by God. There is no difference here. So he's like, stop it, you guys. There's an equal brokenness here and an equal rescuing here. And so when you look at each other through those lenses, and one of the ways he says that we often misuse this is what I call either gift projection or ministry projection. He talks to people and says, look, we all have been given gifts by God. Use your gifts. If you're a leader, lead. If you're a teacher, teach. If you're a server, serve. If you're a generous person, be generous. If you're a merciful person, be merciful. He says, live in that. But you've got to be careful about thinking highly of yourself and thinking that your gifts and your passions and your ministry passions are above other people's. Stop projecting that onto other people. Rather, live faithfully in what God has given you and let other people live faithfully in what God has given them. He says, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. He says, be devoted to one another in love and all these differences. And he says, honor one another above yourselves. He has this model of God has gifted you in a particular way. Live into it. And when you see other people living out their passions that God has given them and living out their ministry that God has given them and living out their gifting that God has given them, he says, honor them above yourself. I want you to just catch that for a moment. What's your passion? What has God given you that you're passionate about? Are you really into discipleship? Has God given you gifts of leadership? Live into it. And then look for other people who have a different gift set and a different ministry passion and make sure you talk about them a lot. Is your passion missions? Is your passion kids? Is your passion college student? Is your passion worship? Is your passion generosity? Oh, God says he's given that to you. Live in that passion. Love it. And I want to challenge you, says Paul. Now look at people who have different ministries and different passions and different giftings, and make sure you lift them up and talk about them a lot. Honor them above yourselves. Another translation, which I love, is outdo one another in honor. He says, part of why we have divisions is we think of ourselves too highly. We forget that the gospel of God has equalized the playing field. There's no bragging rights in the church. So what we're do is to call to live faithfully in what God has given us and then uplift up others who are living in their faithfulness more than we uplift our passions, our ministry, our giftedness. Man, is that a message for the church? Is that a message for our church? We outdo one another. And then when we hurt each other, which happens in the church, there's this sense of practice doing good to one another, even when we're treated poorly. Romans 12:17, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Hey, there's going to be conflict in the church. We're called to forgive as God has forgiven. And this idea that we will be hurt, but that our posture towards one another because of the gospel, because of what God has done for us, if he has forgiven us when we didn't even ask for it, if he's pursued us, if he's forgiven you, then we at least owe that to one another, to treat one another as God has treated us. Does that mean we get stomped on as doormats? Not at all. There's boundaries and all that, but even the way we go about that is done with grace, with kindness, with a desire for reconciliation, giving the benefit of the doubt, knowing that we're looking at each other as sister and brother together. It's a church. This is who we're supposed to be. It's a countercultural movement. It's a renewing of our mind. It's seeing each other different than the patterns that we see in our world. So I just want to take a moment to share pastorally my hope for our church. I mean, my hope for the church with a capital C, but since we're here today, what's our hope for University Covenant Church? I think I want to just share a bigger picture first thing and just to understand, Romans is a highly theological book, but I want you to catch how much strong church relationships and deep theology go together. Our love for one another is not just based out of simple mantras, oh, we should be loving, oh, we should be kind. Those are all true, but there's a depth as to the why. And if we forget the why, then our love for one another will begin to soften. We'll start dividing over things that need not to be divided over. But when we dwell in the deep theology, the why of our brokenness before God across all differences, and the righteousness that God gives us of his righteousness available to all people through faith in Christ, that deep theology affects a simple, what do I do when we're different? What do I do when our passions are different? What do I do when you hurt me? What do we do for one another? It's a totally different perspective in light of deep theology. So I just want to challenge you, church, not to separate our love for one another from deep theology. If we forget the why, then our love for one another will soften and become surfacey. We've got to know the why. We've all been rescued by God, and that gives us a bit of humility. Male, female, every ethnicity, rich, poor, we've all been rescued. There's no bragging when you've been rescued. There's a humility as we look for one another, at one another. We say we are for one another because we all have experienced the same thing that God has done for us. Here's another pastoral hope for us, is because we are called to live in our lane in terms of gifting and passion and outdo one another who's have other passions, this outdoing one another implies that we also share each other's burdens. And I think in our divided world, when things come on the news, when injustice is done, when one people group hurts in particular, because we are now family, we now take on each other's burdens. If we see a people group that is hurt in our society, we don't just play it off. We check in with one another and say, how does that affect you? How, as me, as a brother and sister to you, how can I outdo you in honor and take on your burdens? And this takes on any ethnicity. I just want to say, certainly in the last couple years, there's been tension and hurt with our Black brothers and sisters, and we need to take that on and share that. There's nothing wrong with that. That should be done more in our church. Anything where Asian brothers and sisters are hurt as well. But I also want to say this also applies to white brothers and sisters too. There's a way in our society where white, especially white men, are demonized or seen as subhuman. And that also is not of the gospel, that we can take on even majority culture as well, that we are in this together and we're taking on each other's burdens and saying, how can we outdo one another in honor? I'd say the third thing I want us to realize is the importance of the church. we can't control what goes on in our society. Certainly we want to be a good influence, but we do have stewardship of the relationships in our own church. That's the area where God's kingdom kind of comes alive. And just another kind of picture of who we are as a church, you need to remember that in Genesis chapter 1, the Garden of Eden was an experience where God's presence was with humanity. Or another way of saying it, it's where heaven and earth were one. That got broken. It got broken through sin. This idea of God with humanity, the heaven and earth in one. But God gave us a preview, something to hold on to for the future redemption of when he bring those two things together, heaven and earth. And that first thing was something called the tabernacle. It's a traveling tent. But in that tabernacle, the Garden of Eden was recreated. It was a place where God's presence dwelt with humanity, where heaven and earth came together again. Later, that was transferred to the temple, a permanent structure where heaven and earth met again, where people go to the temple and experience a taste, a preview of heaven. But when the temple was destroyed, that transferred once again. And now it's the community of people called the church together. When we come together, brothers and sisters, and we live out a countercultural relational movement because of the theology, because of the gospel, God's presence is among us. This is where heaven and earth meet now, the church. And when I say church, it's not the building, it could happen in the building, but it's the people of God together loving one another. It's why Jesus says that all people will know you're my followers by your love for one another. Why? Because that is where people experience Jesus. It's the new heaven on earth when we love each other well because of what God has done for us. It's a taste, it's a preview of heaven to come. This is why the church is so important, brothers and sisters. It's the light of the world, and I really mean that. It's the salt of the earth. The church is not just a place to go to, but it's a place to live out a counter-cultural movement in response to God's good news, and it's lived out in how we love one another. That is a countercultural movement to what's going on around us. It is so vital. It is the hope of the world, brothers and sisters. It gives people a taste of what's to come. See, when people become believers, often God is doing something in their hearts, but it is also complemented by an experience of God's church, of people love one another, and they're going, what's going on here that's so different than what I've experienced out there? This is why it's worth everything. This is why when Paul ends his letter, he talks about his personal experience with people, and he shares the love and the labor he's gone through with so many of his brothers and sisters. He is all in. Church, I want to challenge you to be all in this community. This is not just something you attend. This is something you become. It's a way you live out love for one another in relationships. You've got to rub shoulders and love well. So, Lord, I pray this is true for us. Church, I pray this is true for us, that what God has done for us through Jesus' death on the cross will translate concretely into who we are with one another. Oh, I love this journey. I love our church. I love it because God loves it too. God bless you guys.